Welcome to Failing Up. We don't have a theme song.
Well, we might not have a theme song, Eden, but we do have a theme, and that is failure.
And we talk to people about their failures and mistakes and how they grew from it.
Simple as that. Listen up.
Hello, everyone. I've never started the podcast like that.
Way too serious.
Welcome to Failing Up. Hi, Guy. How are you?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm good. I wanted to start off today before we introduce our guests.
Yes.
I know that we, like, it's about failure and rejection and all this stuff. And I got a rejection letter this week.
Okay.
And normally, if you work in, like, Hollywood or something, you don't get rejection letters. You just never hear back.
Mm-hmm.
But I decided to write rites of, like, okay, so you know that essay thing for the New York Times called Modern Love? It's like an essay type of thing. So they have a new one called Rites of Passage.
Okay.
I don't have a modern love story, but I always wanted to write one. But I have a rites of passage story, and I thought, oh, this is great. I got a really good one. I wrote one. I felt it was really, like, great and different. I sent it in, and I got rejected.
Wow.
And this is the letter they send. They send back. They
say, it's an email?
It's an email.
Oh.
Thank you for submitting to Rites of Passage. Your essay isn't a fit for our needs at this time, but we wish you the best of luck and appreciate you taking the time to share your story. Warm regards, Anya and Jessica.
Wow.
Now.
Warm regards is like, go fuck yourself, isn't it?
And two people, Anya and Jessica.
You got rejected twice.
Who has a joint email? What idiot?
That's like those couples that have the same Facebook together.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's awful.
Or like a joint Instagram, which I think is only fine if you're sharing a dog. But anyway, so I'm going to introduce your guest.
Wait, hold on. I got a really quick question. So you were saying most of the time you don't hear back. Is it better to, and we'll ask our guest this as well. Is it better to not hear back or is it better to get a rejection?
No, actually I got a rejection letter from a producer a couple weeks ago being like, it's not the fit with our brand, but you're great. Which is like, I don't know. I feel like it still stung and I'd rather not hear, but at least I don't have to focus on it
right.
And like keep wondering like...
It's better than being ghosted, essentially.
Yeah, it is a lot like dating. I thought about that.
Yeah.
I did get rejected by Jimmy Kimmel for when I applied to write there last year.
Congratulations.
Thank you. And then the head writer asked me to submit again. And I was like, no, really? Dog, no. I'm not doing that again.
The head writer, Molly McNerney?
No.
Oh.
It's Danny Ricker now.
Gotcha.
I'm not submitting. I got a movie to work on.
Really? So you're not... Let's introduce the guest and then let's get into...
Going off on my rejection. Ladies and gentlemen, we have a great guest today. We have Rafael Casal. What's up?
Yo.
Hey.
I'm here.
Thank you for coming.
Let's talk about failure.
Oh my gosh, it's the best.
It's the best.
It makes people feel so good about themselves.
Yeah. It does.
Yeah.
So let's start. I mean, even though we like to start with, you know, the beginning. But let's just ask that general question. For you, would you rather get rejection back or would you rather not hear?
I think I'd probably rather not hear.
Really?
I think I like to keep the train moving and not have anything kind of slow it down.
They still like me. They just haven't had a chance to write back. Is that the thought? Like, because for me, I think I'm on Eden's side where I'd rather hear back and it's just there's a closure at least.
No, I think as long as I don't hear back, I can't speculate on anything.
Right.
And if I speculate, I think I'll go down that road where I'm like, oh, so you just don't think I'm dope?
Yeah, I get that.
Well, I'll show you, you know, and I'll never come there again. You know, and that doesn't really work out for me. So you can just be checking off places that I can't go for work.
Right, and then like the fire burning.
Yeah, like on my list of I'll show you would be so deep at this point. That, like,
there should be like a spreadsheet that's shared with all these people.
It's my great people. Like if I ever win an award, I'll just go up there and go, I'd like to fuck off these 200 people.
I think I joked about that once. It was like, I'd like to be a big fuck you to everyone who said no to me.
Here's
like,
a long list, just a long scroll.
Instead of thanking people, you're just like, fuck you, this guy and that guy. I don't like you guy either.
Rejected seven times by this company, so just fuck that company.
In general.
And anyone with suck. Joint email accounts.
I know.
You all can
they
kiss my
definitely
ass.
Definitely fuck themselves.
Yeah, yes. No joint email accounts. You know, that's... We don't even have one for this podcast.
I think it sort of splits off the blame a little bit. Like, you can't get really mad. Like, it's clear that one of them wrote it.
Right.
But two of them have signed it, and it's like, all right, which one of you hates me more?
Anya and Jessica both sound like they went to Wesleyan or some shit.
And if it was two people...
It was Anya, for sure.
It was Anya.
See, I'm thinking maybe they have an AA, or is that a form letter?
Oh, I don't know.
Yeah, I actually got a job, but had kind of a rough interview with one of the people not too long ago, and the guy wrote back, "Take care." I'm like, oh, that's a definite like
never
sign.
Talk to me again.
Exactly.
Take but I know care. It was Anya because no one who wrote the email would sign their name second.
Yes.
You know what I'm saying? That would be like such that's a deceptive true. Misdirection. It was definitely you.
Yeah.
And then you tagged her on like, but it might have been her. Like, no, it wasn't. Leave Jessica out of this.
That's brilliant.
Now you know. You know where the path of
fuck
your...
Fuck you, Anya.
Fuck you, Anya.
Yeah.
I don't need your fucking New York Times no. shit.
Who wants to be the
you guys
New York Times?
Like you said you normalized Nazis or something, right?
Didn't the president say you're failing?
I think they're doing pretty well.
Yeah,
they're a great institution.
Best thing they're doing in a long time.
I know. Anyway, let's get back to you, Raphael.
Let's talk about your childhood. Where did you grow? Where were you born? Where did you grow up?
I was born in the Bay Area in Berkeley, California. I grew up between Berkeley and Oakland, California.
Awesome.
I'm a Northern Cali person. Did you know that people in Northern California hate LA?
I knew this.
In general, yes.
Because I'm from LA.
Yeah.
So when I go to Oakland or Berkeley.
Isn't it amazing how much hostility we have?
It's like, what?
What I learned when I moved down here is that no one down here knows about that.
I know.
I came down here and I was like, fuck this town. And they were like, why? We love the Bay Area. Why would you? What is this blatant one-directional hostility? Yeah. And I was like, wait a minute. I thought...
I gave my number to someone from the Bay Area, and they're like, what's this 323 bullshit?
Oh, shit.
And I was like, oh, no, you guys don't like L.A., do you?
No, but here's the secret. We have no reason.
Do you ever have a reason? Like,
there's usually some petty reason. We don't even have a petty reason.
Aren't we, like, against sports teams, maybe?
Yeah, but we share a sports team.
That's true.
Yeah. We have the Raiders. They came to L.A.
I know.
They came back to Oakland.
That's true.
Now they're leaving us both for Vegas. It's a terrible thing.
Basketball. I went to a Warriors game here.
Yeah.
And I went with a Warriors fan, too.
It's serious business.
It's serious. There was no Clipper fan.
None. Really?
And I'm a Clipper fan. And I was like, what? I'm going to get killed. Huh. Yeah. I hate Lakers, though.
I was at that game. The Clippers-Warriors game?
Yeah.
That was a good game.
It was a good game.
Didn't you guys win? Wait a minute. Who won?
No, you guys won.
But, like, barely. Like, it wasn't the landslide that we thought it was going to be.
No, they did okay.
That's what it was. I remember, like, being in the third quarter being like, wait a minute.
I'm a little disappointed lately, though, with the Clippers, but they're fine. Like, I'm not a Lakers person.
Maybe. I'm not a Lakers person. The Clippers would be my team here. Like, I go to Clippers games. I can't go to a Lakers game.
I know.
Yeah.
Someone didn't, I think they didn't hire me. They asked me, I went to a job interview and I was like 20 or something. They're like, oh, you're a sports fan? I'm like, yeah, just some, like basketball. And they're like, you like the Lakers? And I was like, no. And I felt like it was the wrong answer.
The conundrum is if somebody offered me floor seats to the Lakers because like my vanity of being on the floor.
Oh, right.
Versus my hatred for the Lakers. Like, that's a toss up.
I would have to take that.
I might have to take it.
Yeah. You might sit next to Jack Nicholson. Who knows?
You might. Oh, that would be incredible.
Exactly.
Then I wouldn't watch the game. I'd just be like, sliding over like, so what do you think of Joaquin Phoenix as the Joker? Do you think that's, exactly. Maybe that's going to go well? Or?
I think one of the worst teams to be a sports fan of, though, out of the general area is the Yankees. Like, I catch so much shit
from New York.
For being, I know, but even so, like,
I blocked it out of my mind. I did not even notice that had
people hate it. They hate it unless they love it. They hate, there's no, it's polarizing. There's no, like, oh, you know, it's like, oh, the Yankees, go fuck yourself. Like, people have literally said that to me, like, go fuck yourself. I'm like, oh, cool.
It just feels like the empire.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I get it, you know, it's just that's where I grew up.
But again, I got nothing. I have no tangible reason. Love the color blue. I think the logo's great. Yeah, can't name a single player.
Right. Yeah.
I got nothing.
So you grew up in the Bay Area. Was it like a rough area? Was it a
gentrified area?
Yeah. My part of Berkeley got gentrified like in my teens. Like became like a really like comfortable middle class neighborhood. When we moved there, it was less so. So it was pretty like there were like some nice families in the neighborhood. There was like for sure a crack house on our block. Mm-hmm. Like we ran the spectrum.
That felt like area. Me in LA. I lived in an area at the time was not the safest and then got super gentrified. And when I was a kid, like the riots happened.
Yeah.
And it was right by my house. Like,
really?
It's crazy. And now it's completely gentrified. So I feel that.
Yeah. I rep because the Bay Area is so territorial about where you grew up, I have to forever rep Berkeley. Like every time somebody asks me where I'm from, I'm like, Berkeley and Oakland has to be that way.
Right.
But I don't feel at home in Berkeley anymore. Like it's just a different city. Like everyone I know now lives in Oakland. And I've had enough Oakland addresses where I'm like, that's sort of where my base feels.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then that, like, we lived in some rougher neighborhoods in the town for sure. And I mean, I live here now. Like every time I go out and visit, it's kind of like I'm popping around, like sleeping at family and friends' houses,
right.
And shit like that.
Did you have to fight growing up?
Yeah, I fought a lot.
Yeah. And what was it? Getting jumped? Was it like, were you the troublemaker? What was the reason?
I for sure got jumped a lot young, like way younger.
Yeah.
Like middle school. Mm-hmm. I think when it started getting rough. But I had a good group of male friends, and they all got, like, I was tiny, but they got big.
Yeah.
Which was great.
That helps. Yeah, that helps up friends in high places, literally.
Yeah, like, they were, you know, I had, like, two or three different crews that I ran with, and they were all kind of rougher around the edges. Dude, we didn't start that way. We knew each other since we were kindergartners. Mm-hmm. But I think, like, that part of that sect of the school, just like that was our currency. It was like, who's the tough one, who's talking the most shit, who's got the funniest joke, and like who can back that shit up. Right. And I definitely like had the joke.
Yeah. Good.
You gotta have one of those.
Had the joke, fucked. You know, and like that was the beginning of me like being in that, you know, somebody would mess with me and like they'd mess with me for a while and then eventually be like, oh, I got a good comeback right now.
Yeah.
Fire off, and then they give you that look, and like the first couple years were like, all right, and this is where I got my ass whooped. And then, you know, like fight by fight, you start going like, oh, if you punch them like right in the nose, right.
That will shock,
you know,
them.
First, if you do it first before the fight starts,
the trick.
You'll be all right. And really, you don't actually have to do it that many times. Like one time, solid time a year, everyone's kind of like, it'll hit you back.
Yeah.
You know, and that kind of moves it on.
I went to a Hebrew school till I was in sixth grade, and then seventh grade I decided to go to a public school. My first day of seventh grade, and it was a tough school.
In New Jersey?
In New Jersey, Lakewood, New Jersey. It was like 30% white, you know, so 70% other, and a lot of that other were in gangs and stuff. Anyway, I still remember this. I'm getting dressed for gym class the first day, and my lunch money, which was a dollar, fell out of my pocket. And this humongous black kid, I'm serious, he was like 6 foot something in seventh grade, picks it up. And I'm like, oh, it's my dollar. He's like, it's my dollar now.
What's the end of
and
that?
And I said, no, it's my lunch money, though. I don't know why. I'm stupid enough to say
You wanted to make sure they understood, like, the gravity of the crime?
He goes, it's my lunch money now.
Yeah.
And my dumbass says, okay, well, if you need that much, then it's your dollar. And the guy took his hand, and he reared back, and he went to, like, throw a punch in my face and stopped and then opened his hand up and my dollar was in there. And he's like, what's your name, man? And I said, Guy. He goes, you're my boy now, Guy. Yeah, and he actually, I'm not kidding, later on in my junior year, he saved me because he was part of this gang. They stole my bag. He runs back. He's like, you're not taking Guy's bag.
Yeah.
It's fucking crazy. And so the humor, it was enough that I stood up to this guy that like...
Humor saves.
Yeah.
Yeah, wow. We sat right in between. We, like, my crew weren't... No one in our crew was really, like, my immediate crew were really, like, gang members. Mm-hmm. But all of our friends were.
Yeah.
So it was kind of like if stuff happened, like, no one ever got messed with. And I was for sure the smallest dude. And my whole crew was black and brown kids. Like, there was no one was going to come up and do anything crazy. There was, like, the middle school years and, like, freshman year of high school of, like, let's claim a little bit of space.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then for the most part, it was fine. Like, stuff would happen at parties or, like, on Saturday nights out somewhere with kids that we didn't know.
Right. Yeah.
But that was kind of the bulk of it.
What did you want to be when you were a young man? Like, growing up, what do you think?
Like,
you
were what age are we talking here?
I mean, anywhere from, you know, little kid, 5 years old, all the way to when did that change? I want to be a magician at five.
Yeah,
I still think that's really weird.
People do that. They're like, oh, I always wanted to be an astronaut when I was a kid. I was like, I have no idea what I wanted to be. I think I just wanted to have a good time and like do like be good at something.
The weirder is we've had multiple people on this show. They're like, oh, well, I want to be a writer. I saw Sesame Street and I was like, I could be a writer too. And I'm like, who the fuck thinks of that at 5 years old? Like, who even realizes they could write? Like, maybe five. I'm exaggerating a little bit, but seriously, like, 7, 8, 9, they're like, oh, I knew what I wanted to do. Like,
I wanted to be a witch.
Still don't know what I want to do.
Yeah, like, if I wanted to be anything, it was something that was truly impossible.
Yeah, like a fucking unicorn or dragon slayer or something.
I think anyone who ends up in the arts in any capacity at one point wished for something truly, truly impossible and just got comfortable with that fantasy and, like, sat with it for a while.
I still want to be a witch. Fuck it.
That's the thing. It's like, it's still somebody who was like, I think I can make you a witch. Wouldn't you be like, how?
Yeah.
Would you want to hear? Tell me more of this story. I'd like to know practically how you would make that.
Take my money too. I want
even if we can just convince everyone that I am a witch, that's enough.
Close enough, yeah.
They should have a master class on how to become a witch.
I'm sure that exists.
Like, hello, I'm, I don't know, fucking Kathleen Turner, and this is my masterclass.
On
witchcraft.
How to be a witch. So okay, at some point
that would be fantastic.
I know, right?
How are there no spoof masterclasses for like really mundane things?
I pitched that.
That has to exist.
SNL.
Like here's how you sew a button on, but it's an hour.
No, right? I pitched one to SNL, and it was I think it was Ronan Farrow teaching men how to write an apology letter.
Can you pitch one sketch to SNL? Can you just send in one?
Yeah, you can.
Really?
Yeah.
I'm going to talk about that.
Was
later.
It? Yeah. I think it was Norm MacDonald, actually, that he did that. And I think it was for SNL. He was like, I'm just going to... He had one joke, and he sent in the one joke.
Yeah, you can send one joke.
And they're like, yeah.
If they buy it, yeah.
Yeah.
I actually think it's good to send just one, because then, then you're not comparing it, you know?
Yeah.
So, yeah.
They're not checking your consistency. It's just like, was this one a...
It's like, well, that one's kind of shitty, but, yeah. You know.
But they'll forget you immediately if it's bad.
Yeah.
But, yeah. I mean... So what? When, like, I guess, did you even think of, like, what can I do for a living? How can I make money? Or, like, what's a career?
God, I'll let you know when that comes up.
No, right?
So when did you realize, or when did you figure out what you wanted to actually do? Or what did you think you wanted to do when you were...
I think this is still the problem, is that people, like, especially now we just put this film out, like all my meetings are like, well, what is the main thing you want to do? And I was like, if you look at my career, I have never made that decision, and I'm not making it now. Like, I don't suddenly have focus. Like, there's like seven things I want to do. Mm-hmm. I've done all of them to some degree, and I'm like incrementally keep adding to the pile of each one of them.
It's funny, we had a guest. Remember Sarah Benicasa?
Of course.
She wrote a book about this, and she said that most artists have, like, at least at one given point, like 10 things they want to do.
Yeah.
And asking them to focus on one is torture.
But also, if you look up any of the artists that you admire, like, they didn't pick one either. No. Like, none of the people that you're going after or modeling after have ever done that. You're sort of known for a thing. There's, like, one sort of low-hanging fruit that everyone's like, oh, that person was an author.
Right.
It's like, yeah, they were an author, and they wrote short stories and poems. They wrote a play. They wrote a screenplay. Like,
sure.
So how did you get your start as an artist? What was your first thing?
Did you know you were good at something? Let's put that.
I think the first thing that I ever like got any sort of feedback on that was outside of my immediate family was I started in the performance poetry world. So I started doing that when I was like 13 or 14. And I went to Berklee High School, which is a massive high school. And at the time, I think it's like a fairly nice school now. At the time, we were coming off of, I think I got there like 2 years after this documentary called School Colors came out that was all about like gang violence in high schools. Mm-hmm. So I remember I like, saw that and then I went there. I was like, oh shit.
Wow.
But that high school was 4,000 students. So like really finding your place is near impossible at that,
right,
at that scale. Our football team, sorry to all of my homies, cause they're all still my friends. They all played on the football team. Our football team was bad, but they tried hard and they had spirit. but the poetry slam, like we were sort of the beginning of this, what is now this big youth poetry movement that like Brave New Voices does is all over the country. But it kind of like Ground Zero was kind of my high school. This organization You Speak started it in the Bay Area and started it at Berklee High. And so we would have these poetry slams every other week. And 300 kids would show up to watch it. You'd win $50 if you won the thing.
Yeah.
They were like, you were judged by your peers. And like, that was a really interesting cocktail of like a self-contained art scene. Mm-hmm. And so I would just like, I think my sister signed me up the first time because she'd found a bunch of mine that I'd written in the house. I was doing music sort of before that, but like this before Pro Tools, you could buy it at the house or you could even have a home studio. Like, none of that was available yet. And so going up and reading something a cappella is like, doesn't cost anything, you don't need any equipment. And so I would go and bomb and, you know, and do terrible, but it's such a like,
it was like
that scene is very supportive. Like they really do actually want
an open mic.
Yeah. It's not like a, you know, now there's slams that are a little bit like more, more hostile. But when it's teenagers, it's like dope. Like this is before we had this phrase, but like, that's your truth. Like, cool.
Right.
You know, and then you score up the people who are dope. And that's sort of how you send the subtle hint. Like you should be more like them. You know, you should do this.
But when somebody sucks, right? How do you? I mean, it's just that people aren't reacting.
There's always like a couple people in the crowd that are just like super hippie, love kids because it's like Berklee and Oakland, it's the Bay Area. We're super lefty, so like you just get support for like being yourself,
right?
So there's always those kids, and then you get like the polite applause, and then your scores suck. Usually the scores are always between 8 and 10. Like that's how polite the poetry scene is. Like you
it's
don't
like,
get
oh, shit,
like if somebody gives you 7.5, it's like meet you outside, motherfucker. Like
yeah, we got some issues.
Yeah, we got some issues. That's disrespectful. these are my feelings, and they're valid, and they deserve an 8. but so you just kind of kept going back, and it's not like I was. naturally super good at it. I'm just an obsessive workaholic. And so like, I would see, you know, I'd see people like kind of scribbling down their thing right before they walked in there. And I've been working on mine for weeks and I'm making revisions on the way in, but I've been working on it the whole time.
Right. Yeah.
I was just trying to outwork people, really.
Right.
And what are you writing about at as a teenager?
I mean, it's, I think you're just like, so, you know, you're it's so self-indulgent and you're just trying to sort out your own shit, right? Like, I think some of the pieces then that were like winning the most competitions for me were about, I had one that was about my grandmother's Alzheimer's that was the thing. The murder rate was really high. I wrote one about that. There were ones about, like, it was weird because we were also, like, the slam was getting so big at a certain point that we were selling out, like, Herb's Theater in San Francisco. It was, like, 3,000 seats.
Wow.
You know, so you're, it's like, there's a scene. There's, like, groupies and fans and, like, right. The whole, you know, this whole, you know, sub-scene is happening in the Bay Area. So there were ones that even were, like, that were just, like, yeah. You know, rhyme acrobatics that were just like, let me show you how good I am at this wordplay. Mm-hmm. I think I had one that was just that for like, you know, 4.5 minutes.
Wow.
And you're just trying to rally up the, you know, the judges. So you do like one that was sort of like showy for first round and then something really sort of heartfelt for second round.
I feel like it's verbal gymnastics.
Yeah.
It's like...
Well, like, depending on the era, like, now poetry is so... The spoken word scene, at least, is so much about like kind of digging into the feeling. There's a lot of... You know, the middle section, not the folks who are really, really killing, but sort of the middle passage of like good to great is a lot of crying, mm-hmm. which gets a little old.
Yeah.
And it's like, and it's sort of emotionally draining for the audience, which is why I can't stomach most of it. But then when I see the people sort of pull out in the lead, which is very few, it's a scene that like is mostly because I've been in it for so long, it's hard to stomach. But the people who are really sensational, like know how to give you something,
right.
Something relevant, something sort of, you know, emotionally tasking, but like not so much that you're like,
yeah.
Blah.
Right.
You know,
for you, is it who's better? The people who can freestyle it or the people who actually take the time to craft it and like
for a spoken word?
Yes.
Oh, absolutely not anyone who freestyles. Like, what could you possibly, well, how could you possibly enhance my life in 3 minutes freestyling?
That's the thing.
Like, skill wise, you can. There was an era where that was awesome, where you could just watch somebody like go off, but then just watch people freestyle. It's the act of seeing somebody pull something out of their brain improvisationally is brilliant. It's why you go to like an improv
right.
show.
Right.
But spoken word is like, now it's like it's a YouTube thing. We did it on television. Like, this has to last,
mm-hmm.
which means the message of it has to be something premeditated.
Right.
Remember we had Zach Sherwin on?
Mm-hmm, of course.
I saw him. I didn't know he does this, but I saw him at a show. I didn't know it was freestyle. I thought he went on like a 4 minute. He only had 4 minutes. And he went off and I was just like shocked. And it was about... how he felt that night, and I was shocked he just pulled it out of his head. I know,
it's amazing to see somebody do that.
I know, but
it's sort of a different, like, that's a different art form,
right. Yeah,
which is also awesome, but like I would go to the freestyle show for that. I'd go to the battle for that.
That
skill set is fucking brilliant.
What do you think you love most about poetry and the scene and all that? Is it how it makes you feel? Is it how you make other people feel? Is it the reaction people give you when they, you know, when you move them? What is it?
It's probably twofold. Like, I like the... It's one of the few places where you have an immediate, earnest connection with an audience if you do it right. So there's this, like...
Yeah.
There's this communal empathy that starts to happen around something that you're talking about. It's one of the only places that you can hold court with a community in that way, not as a politician or as, like, purely as an entertainer.
I know.
It's an acceptable place to talk about serious things. But also, I get a high off beautiful language. If somebody says something that's just like, that isn't shallow, that isn't just pretty for the sake of being pretty, mm-hmm. but that like, that is beautifully crafted on the page and means something.
Yeah.
Like, that's one of those art form. It's an art form that is literally accessible to everyone who has access to the language.
Yeah.
Or language in general, right? Like, people are doing it in French and in Spanish, and this is all over the place.
Mind blowing. Yeah.
And when done well, and I'm a snob now, but mostly just because I'm exhausted, you know,
you've heard it all. You should be a snob. You're just picky.
Yeah, I'm just picky. And there's a difference between like nurturing new artists and being like highbrow about what I would curate,
you know,
for myself. But the truly amazing spoken word artists are. If it's short and sweet and beautiful, it's transformative. It really is.
Okay, that's fair. So I mean, it's kind of the whole experience of it. It sounds like you really love.
Yeah.
I think it's brilliant. What I like hearing spoken word poetry and all that stuff is that you could cram so much information and stuff into like such a short, because like as a writer, everything seems to me very edited and like you have to, can't be more than this, can't be longer than that. And like you can I don't know. I feel like when you do that, you can cram a lot into very little. Yeah,
it's structure, right? It's the same thing with being a stand-up comic. Like, right. There's a certain amount of time that can go on before you need to make a joke.
Right, right.
You know, depending on how much trust you have earned from the audience. But those constraints, you know, when mastered, are like, it's the high also just watching someone like nail the form.
Right.
It's like, God, this person, you know, when there's certain stand-up specials I watch, I'm like, this person just has the audience like this.
Yeah.
And can completely take this any way they want, because more so than they're convinced that he or she is funny.
Right.
It's that they trust this person.
Yeah.
I love watching somebody earn an audience's trust, like in an infallible way.
Yeah. It's also fascinating. I've seen people lose an audience's trust.
Oh yeah.
And it's really interesting to like observe and take in and survey. It's like,
and anyone can lose it too. Like, you know, and on any night you just, your tone is weird.
It's like, it's kind of sad. I feel sad, but I take it. For me, it's helpful.
It's a lesson learned.
I know.
Just like, oh yeah, right. Like, you really got to have your game face on when you stand up there.
Yeah, totally.
And when it comes down to it, would your advice be, if somebody was interested in possibly exploring this, that they are going to have to fuck up a lot of times? They're going to have to fail a lot of times before they're good. Is there anybody that gets up and that's just good? Is that possible?
Yeah, for sure. I think that happens in any sort of artistic or like athletic medium. People have like a natural inclination to be good at a thing.
Mm-hmm.
That person, like the person who sucks at it, is still going to have to make a choice at some point to either do the work or not.
Yeah.
And if they can be great, you know, out the gate. But these mediums are hard. They're incredible. They're labors of love. Right, so I think no matter what, even if you're inherently like just awesome out the gate, this is, if you want to have a future, like you're not gonna make a killing career off of just being a performance poet. The same way, like, I don't know any stand-ups aside from very particular super famous stand-ups with specials that go on to do TV and all this other stuff, but like most of the stand-ups that I know who are great, who are just doing the circuit, are making okay money.
Yeah.
Right.
You know? So if you're gonna do it, you better get fucking great at it. Yeah. So that you can graduate and like expand, you know, your career a bit.
Mm-hmm. And is it similar to other writing where like you can look back and go, oh, that was embarrassing. I was just a stupid 17-year-old kid. Or are you pretty proud of everything that you've written?
I think anything that was like done before 21, I'm like, that was great for a young person.
Yeah.
You know, for a kid.
Mm-hmm. Would you hand it, like, if you found it, would you hand it to me and let me read it? Or would you be too embarrassed and be like,
I wouldn't, because we're sitting here in this year now.
Okay, yeah.
You know, like, if we're gonna share my work with a new audience, I'd be like, sure. Let's share something contemporary.
I love Bill Clinton. What the hell is that?
Maybe, yeah, that's the thing about, like, that's the thing, like, so much of my career started on YouTube, so like I have logs of all the things I've ever said.
Wow. That must be great and terrible at the same time.
It is. I mean, luckily most of it's on my account, so if I really don't like something, I'll just get rid of it.
That's true. That's true.
But I think YouTube is how you even like kind of started blind spotting, no?
Yeah. It was our producers who found poetry videos of mine on YouTube. And
yeah, I actually know your producer. I know.
Oh, Keith. Yeah?
Yeah.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. So I know the story a little bit.
Well, let's hear this story.
Let's hear the story.
Yeah, yeah.
Who gets found on YouTube?
That's everybody, I feel.
There's certainly a lot of writers these days.
I've been found from Twitter.
Yeah.
But
Twitter and YouTube, know, any display
YouTube.
Of...
Huh.
There was a comedy politics show I did for a year and a half a couple years ago, and that got me all my meetings, all my writing meetings in New York at all the talk shows.
Wow.
It was just like, it got sent around. People were like, this kid's funny, and he took down this thing that happened this morning, so like he clearly can write fast.
Exactly.
Let's call him in. You know, it's such a great way to showcase. And suddenly, if you got like 30,000 views on something in a week,
yeah,
people are like, "All right, well, people like
we'll
it."
Listen,
so,
yeah.
You know. So yeah, Jess and Keith found this video about the murder rate in Oakland that I think got taped for a tour or something we were about to do, and they needed videos for it. So we went and filmed it in a theater, and they found it, and we're like, "This is really interesting to be." You know, an undertone of a film in some way, this kind of language.
Yeah.
And I thought Jess was some girl hitting on me or catfishing me or something.
Really?
I know my mother did too.
early days of the internet.
Yeah, right. You never know. I mean, it was the DMs on YouTube. Like, there's not even a thing people realize that there are that you can message. But you can message somebody. I've never checked my DMs like in the last 8 years, but I did at the time.
Wow.
But they came up to the Bay. We like sat. We talked about movies. They're like, we got a feel for each other. We kind of hit it off. And then started like 10 years of going back and forth on like first 2 years on script ideas, finally landed on something. They met David, who I brought the script with and is in the film. And
And we sort of put this script together three or four times over the course of a decade, just this last year and a half.
Was it ever a different story completely?
It's been, we've approached the subject of a police shooting differently because the conversation has evolved.
Of course.
So that's changed a lot. I think the way in which, I think about 3 years after we sort of wrote the first, or like got pretty far on the first draft, was when we found out that Coogler was doing Fruitvale. And we were like, oh, great. We were kind of not sure how much of the shooting we wanted to tell and how much of like the town's reaction to the shooting we wanted to tell. And when we realized he was going to do this thing with Michael B. Jordan that was just the shooting, it was about Oscar Grant, we were like, great. Like, they'll tell that story. Let's tell like the story of everyone else.
Right.
And that's sort of what our film then became about. I think that was the biggest shift.
Okay. Because I feel like sometimes when you start a project, especially on spec, it comes off with like an idea and it can morph into something completely different by the time you're done with it. So I'm curious if this was like...
I think you like figure out what the heart of the thing is and then everything else is up for grabs, right? Like,
yeah.
There were certain scenes we wrote early that are still in the film now. Like I think some of the first three or four scenes we ever wrote for are like in exactly as they were.
Oh, great.
And everything else is sort of changed or reverse engineered around it to like adapt with where the conversation's gone. But
By the way, people, I'm gonna brag about this movie for a second. I saw, this is how I was introduced, beside the fact that I know Keith and he was like talking about it a little bit. I went to see Eighth Grade, the Bo Burnham thing.
I heard that was great.
Yeah. And they had like, I don't know, Arclight does it in the screenings. They only have like two trailers. Mm-hmm. And it was Blindspotting and some other movie. And I forgot the other movie because the Blindspotting trailer was so good. And everybody in the theater, and this theater was packed, was silent and like hooked to this trailer.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah. And I was just like, my friend like turns to me. She's like, we got to see that. I'm like, yeah, I know.
That's awesome.
No, don't worry. It's on the list.
So 10 years though. So, I mean, look, I'm an outsider. I am not a writer. I'm not in Hollywood at all. Other than this, you know, humongous podcast that we have. But I have been a part of situations where they're like, oh guy, we're going to be doing this pilot. And you get all this smoke blowing up your butt. You're like, oh my God, I'm going to have a TV show. I have a pilot. And then, you know, it never, ever happens. It all falls apart.
A lot of movies
don't
happen, yeah.
Yeah. And so, I mean, to start something 10 years ago, there had to have been ups and downs along the way. Like, were there times where you're like, oh shit, this is never, ever going to happen?
Yeah, yeah. We almost made it two or three times. A few times we got to the point at least where we were like going and scouting and like,
oh, wow.
we definitely were getting, but we tried to do it different ways every time. Like, and the budget was changing sort of depending on the year and the way we were going to shoot it, and started talking about who would be cool directors. But yeah, I mean, there's a million and one reasons why you don't get to make a movie. The timing is weird or the market is weird.
I know.
Or are our producers who are trying to like get a production company off the ground, get a deal to make another movie. I'm not saying that's what happened, but like, these are the kind of things that happen when a bunch of artists are trying to get something off the ground. And then the last time we were trying to make it, we were going to shoot it in the summer. And then David got this call to do this Hamilton show, which wasn't
that
a thing then.
Thing.
It was a nothing thing at the time. you know, and we were all just kind of like, all right, well, I guess you'll do this for a couple months and then we'll go shoot the movie.
Right.
And then it became this like big 2 year thing. And I moved to New York and then like he got at least in the New York area, very famous, very
right,
fast.
Right.
We were like, oh, great. Like, we can get all these meetings now. We can try to get a show picked up and a movie made. And I was watching the Oscars and the whole La La Land Moonlight thing happened. And I remember I was like super bummed when Moonlight lost, and then they came back and they did a whole thing, and I was a little drunk. They were like, it's Moonlight, and I was like, oh my God. And then I picked up my phone, as I do sometimes when I'm drunk, and I texted Jess and Keith like with a slightly sassy but loving which was like, we have our Moonlight. we could have made our Moonlight. And then like put the phone down and forgot about it, and like went to sleep. Day or two went by. I was like, I have no recollection of this text. And they wrote back, and Diggs is like off shooting a TV show or something at this point. And they wrote back and they were like, were you serious about that? Like, why did you say that? And I was like, oh no, I like pissed off my friends.
Oh no.
And they were like, no, like we thought you guys were over it. We're like exhausted by it. We've tried to do this so many times. We're like, we're great with it. Like we're always ready to go.
Yeah.
There's so much of this part of the process that we don't understand. And there's always a reason we can't do it. Like, would you guys still want to do it? And they flew to New York 2 days later, put the money on the table. We're like,
whoa.
Go see if Diggs wants to do it. Diggs was like, sure, but I can't, like, we need to rewrite the script. You haven't looked at it in 2 years.
Right.
We're way better writers and performers than we were 2 years ago. You'd have to rewrite this on your own. I have to go do TV stuff for the next 2 months, and then I'd be able to, like, meet you on day one of shooting and be there for a month to shoot it, and that's it. And that's what we ended up doing. Is like, I think the next day I moved to LA, wrote in a room for a month. We did a little table read, and then we went into pre-production.
Wow, amazing.
Yeah.
That's like, that's, I think, that's, and you never took like a film class before, like any kind
of. Yeah, I've taken, I mean, I worked on, obviously I've worked on the stage a lot as a performer. Right. And I've been in a bunch of different theater companies, but also like I ran a production company for 7 years with post-production and being on set. And I did the whole thing when I first moved to LA 8 years ago. That was like being a PA, being a first AD, right, being a production manager. Yeah. Like I've worked every weird odd job on a set ever. I've directed a ton of like music videos and shorts and all that shit. They're not good, but I did them, you know? Yeah. So like I know the mechanics of what it means to make,
right,
something that anything under like $120,000 I had been a part of, or like a big commercial as a PA.
Right, right.
But this was going to be our first, like, okay, we're going to do like a movie. And for our director as well, like he had never done anything like this before. And so I think we all got to kind of learn what it meant to make a movie at the same time. And luckily we have Jess and Keith, who, you know, like are amazing human beings.
And they're really picky with what they choose.
They're really picky with what they choose because they have very specific tastes. But when they love someone, which they've proven over and over again to, like, for some crazy reason, love me and David the way we love them, they just mentor the shit out of you. Like, they give you every tool possible to succeed, which is, like, kind of unheard of.
Yeah, it's very unheard of. I feel lucky in the sense that I feel like I've gotten that from some people in this business, but it's, when I meet someone in Hollywood who's, like, willing to do that and willing to go the extra step to mentor you, I'm like, whoa, not everyone here is, like, a pretentious dick thinking about themselves and money. And it's, like, refreshing. But
it's
yet,
so warm and loving.
Yeah, and it's why I don't leave. Like, the industry, it's, like, why I don't quit. Because I do think there are good people.
There's a few for everyone if you can find them.
Oh, for sure.
Like, any good artistic medium, you have to get a mentor.
I know. I can't. I don't even call it a mentor for like a lot of people reach out to me and I feel like I'm not experienced enough to mentor. But I always tell people you just need someone to be safe, like someone who's like a safe space to send stuff to that you're not afraid of. That if you produce, because a lot of people will make stuff and they won't send it out and they won't share it with anyone. And you need the feedback from someone professional that's like a safe person that's not gonna, you know, that you trust. The trust thing is really important.
Yeah,
so absolutely. It's great that you found that. And I wish there was like a Big Brothers Big Sisters thing you could do for like
I think
artists.
It's just part, it ends up being the etiquette of the industry. Like,
sure, yeah.
I don't know. Teaching has been a huge thread of my career. And so like that, I think that it's been with David as well. It's been like really ingrained in who we are to be like, well, every time you get through a door, just like pick three people that you would love to see walk through that door and just make sure that you don't not let them know that or not let them know that they can't like come talk to you if they need something. And everyone kind of does that. Like just even if they're not close by or that you're checking in on them all the time. But like if I could suggest someone that's ready for their, that's also what we did with Carlos, our director. They were like, who do you want to direct? That list could have been anybody. We had digs, we had a budget, like we had enough buzz around it. And Justin Keith knew a lot of great directors that I'm sure they would have been like, you know, they could have made us a list in a heartbeat. But we've worked with Carlos before, and we were like, well, if it's up to us, who gets their first film? That door is almost impossible to get through. Yeah. Yeah. So we have the opportunity to make that happen. Like, we should do that. We should give somebody their first film right now and just make sure it's somebody we trust and can work with. And so Carlos was like waiting for me at a cafe a block away. And I was like, my friend is a director. And we gave him the film right then.
Wow.
Awesome.
And so obviously it's doing well. It has like 93% Rotten Tomatoes. Does that matter to you, by the way? Like, do you look at Rotten Tomatoes?
Or like critique?
Yeah, yeah. I think you just want to not be like 48% Rotten Tomatoes.
93. Like that to me, that's like, look, the internet as a whole, people are assholes. So like if you get over 90% of anything, that means something.
93 means the snobs approve.
I know.
And I care to a certain degree if they approve, just because I think when you're trying to make something that has like a sophisticated intellectual undertone, that you're trying to make like a larger point.
Yeah. Right.
If they pick up on it and respect the point of the film, mm-hmm. then awesome. You know?
And do you realize, like, from the get-go, are you like, oh, this is really great? Or are you like, oh, I hope people get it? You know, at the end of the day, when you finish the movie or when you finish writing it, are you like, I know this is good, but will people really understand?
I think there's, like, I know there's good moments in here. Mm-hmm. Okay. Whether or not they amount to a good film, who knows?
Yeah.
The marketplace matters so much. What people saw right before they saw this matters so much. Like, I feel like to a certain amount, there's, like, a certain degree, there's just, like, an unpredictability about how people will receive a thing. Mm-hmm. But I think you can be, like, there's good in here.
Yeah.
Like, I've gone to screenings before, test screenings for people's movies, and I'm like... And they end up doing well in the marketplace. And when I saw it, I was like, it's okay. Like, yeah. There's parts of it that I like.
Right.
But the national conversation changes. People either want escapism or they want something addressed. And, like, and then we decide collectively how we feel about a thing. And that either stays with the film forever or later on, like a year later, people are like, all right, that came out. Wow, that just disappeared.
Yeah.
Because
it
stopped being relevant.
When you're writing it, are you casting yourself out? Like, are you thinking of yourself in the movie or?
When in that one, it was always for us to play. The stuff that we're working on now, like sometimes I usually try to cast the film in my head to write. I'm like, these are the people's voices that I'm writing for.
Okay, so yeah, so that was my next question. So you're thinking like, okay, this is me, and this is how I speak, and like you're...
Yeah. Well, I think what we tried to do with this one was we knew that it would be very unlikely that either one of us, at least up until the point where Diggs had Tony, which I think this changed a little bit for him.
Yeah.
But even then, I think he was getting cast on sitcoms mostly. It's kind of like the funny cousin or the weird boyfriend. and I think at least my goal for it was let's write two characters that we'll never get cast as, mm-hmm. but we'd be the best people to play.
I can't imagine anyone else playing either of your characters. I mean, I
mostly also because it's so site specific that like they would not only have to nail the character but nail the specificity of like the vernacular and the place. And like our biggest accomplishment before even Rotten Tomatoes was like showing it in Oakland and people being like, that's us.
Yeah.
That's who we are. And once we got that feedback, we're like, fuck everybody. Right. We're done. Like we're at least famous. We at least can go home.
Famous, I love it.
We at least can like go to a restaurant home. People are like, aren't you? Yes, I am.
Yeah. And did you win at Sundance too?
We were the opening night feature at Sundance. Okay, that was like our big.
I remember
that was our big claim to fame there.
I remember when I saw the movie, I honestly did not expect it to be as funny as it was. And I'm going to say this. I'm a snob with comedy, especially in movies.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was just like, this is so funny. There were moments when it wasn't even the dialogue. It was just your guys' like cadence.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was like, it is something that you can't even write. It's like the way you guys played it that just fucking worked.
Oh, that's awesome.
And it was like, oh, yeah. And the like people all around us were just like howling.
That's awesome.
And it was so refreshing to see a movie that's actually funny. And, like, not cheap shots or, like, cheap jokes, but, like, about a really serious issue. And there's not enough of that.
It sort of employs the same tactic that, like, all my favorite stand-up comics do, which is, like, take something really serious and try to find, like, the release valve for it.
Right.
Because I think, like, I fancy myself like a stand-up will never do it. Like, in my head, I'm like it's, like, it's my favorite artistic medium by far. I'm in such awe of stand-up. So, like, anytime I get to write funny stuff for either me or other people in a script, I'm like, oh, this is a blast.
Right.
Because I still don't have to go up there and do it or I can blame someone else if it sucks.
Right.
But the funniest scene in the whole movie to me is mostly improv, or is like a combination of improv and then us like building the film around it, is Utkarsh doing the retelling of why Colin goes to jail.
Yeah.
Which I had written what I thought was a very funny version of that story, and then Utkarsh came in and was like, I'm just going to kind of go, which is what all great like improv actors do.
Yeah.
And he landed some of the funniest fucking lines in the movie. Like, you know, every time I sit in a theater, like, those are the biggest howling moments where you're like, oh, man, like, him saying that my character hates his dad, like, over and over again. That's just, like, an observation. Like, and then this guy's kicking him. And then he's like, I hate my dad! As, like, an ad-lib for a thing. Like, our whole crew was falling out laughing.
Yeah. Yeah, it must be really gratifying to go see it with people and like
that's the
see
best the
reaction.
Like
yeah.
with an audience of people that love the thing.
That's why I love being in like LA to see movies, because like I saw Simple Favor last week and like people from the movie were in the theater.
It's great. Like I went and popped in on a random showing at I think it was the ArcLight.
Yeah,
and her name is her. I'm so terrible with names, but she was the leading lady in Slumdog Millionaire. She's also in a film.
Oh,
with Leslie
I sat
Odom.
Frida Pinto.
Yes, Frida Pinto.
I sat next to her at an award show.
Frida Pinto just comes walking. Like I'm outside, she just comes walking out. She's like, "Oh my god!" I'm like, "Oh my god!"
That's amazing.
Hi, because she's like in a movie with another friend of mine. So she was just in a conversation. She was just in my mind. I'm like,
"Wow!"
Oh, that's right. It's L.A. Like. People
I know.
Who do art also go see art the way that everyone goes and sees art.
Yeah. My friend has a funny joke where she's like, She's like, you can't make fun of a movie if it's bad in LA. It's because you don't know who's in the theaters.
You don't know who's there.
Yeah.
I've made fun of movies in you know, the generals at studios now. And I'm like, well, it's not as bad as that fucking movie. They're like,
I know.
Oh, my husband produced it. I'm like, well, it's still bad, but it's great for your husband. He got an award.
Good for you. He got lots of money.
Good for him. You guys are rich.
Yeah, I know. Stuff. It's a crazy town.
Eddie and I were actually discussing before you got here. I really like one of the actors in your movie, the police officer, Ethan Embry.
Yeah.
He's a gen. Like, both of us have apparently interviewed
him. Yeah. He saved my life once because I needed a passport. And he was like, I got a hookup, but it's kind of shady. So I got a passport in like a day. Thanks to Ethan.
I fucking love that.
He's a great dude.
He's an exceptional actor, too.
Yeah. He's so good. I know.
Like, to do that much with essentially like three lines in our movie, like that man took the whole film to another level. And he. Like I had seen a few other films that he was in, but didn't realize it was him because my first introduction to him was Can't Hardly Wait.
Oh, Can't Hardly Wait. I thought it was Vegas Vacation.
No, Can't Hardly Wait. I had the VHS as a teenager. I was like, this is a funny ass movie about white kids. Like, this is what white kids do in like other high schools. Like, that's not what my high school was like. So it was a fantasy land for me.
Yeah.
Right. I was like, oh, like a college party where there's kegs of beer. They wouldn't have kegs at our school. We had fucking Hennessy and weed. No one had a fucking keg.
Yeah, it's Oakland.
We were all about
Oakland and Berkeley. Like, I don't think I ever saw a keg at a party. Really?
We never had kegs.
No. We had kegs at my
but it's LA
house.
You know, we had a lot of weed. $35.
The hunk in that movie drove a truck.
I know. It's, it's very Midwestern.
It's very Midwest. But I knew him from that, and I clocked him. I was like, that dude's great.
Yeah.
And then I saw him in The Devil's Candy, and I didn't even realize it was him. It was another film that Justin Keith did.
Right.
And then he came on. But I say other than Ethan just being like one of the most awesome people in the world, do you follow him on Instagram?
Yeah. Yes.
Him, so his girlfriend Sunny Mabry, who I also love.
She's a Viner.
She's a Viner. Yeah. Yeah, and I was like a diehard Vine fan. Like, I watched all them shits. Like, that was my procrastination thing all day.
Yeah.
I miss
Vine so much.
Bring it back,
It just, you know what the thing, the problem with, only major problem with Vine was it was really hard to like to become anything on there.
I know.
So it felt like there was just like 20 people who were killing it and then the rest of us.
I tried really. I actually
had some solid Vines.
I think like, so too.
I had one get 30 million.
What?
Like rebinds?
Really?
And I'm not in it. It's me at the zoo, and it's just, there was a goat climbing on a wall, and all I did was I sang, goat on a wall, goat on a wall, what's he walking on, yeah. It was like 20 or 30 million views, and I was like, of course I'm not in it. This could have been my moment.
I had one that was revined like a couple hundred thousand times, and it was just me on my laptop looking up how to turn myself into a dog, like on Google, and then the next shot is my dog at the computer. Oh shit, it worked.
That's where you can be a witch.
I know.
Okay, I'm gonna tell my best Vine.
But like, now I have like Instagram stories and it's just not the same hit.
No.
It's not the same.
Because it doesn't replay.
No.
I want the loop. Part of the joke was the loop. All right, hit it.
My best Vine, I think, was I did it at a bathroom at work. You know, like sometimes they have those automatic soap dispensers. And so I put my hand underneath it and it's just not doing anything. And I go, all right. And then I kind of like look like I jerk it off. And then I let it. It just like jizzes in my hand.
God, guys, we really missed our calling.
Vine it's coming back, though. It is coming back.
No, they did the Vine 2 announcement and then they canned it.
Oh, they really did?
Yeah, it's not happening.
Because I follow a bunch of Viners still on like all these sites.
I follow the ones that I feel like. There were a few Viners that are really funny on Vine. But I knew that was it. I was like, this does not translate the unique combination of why I follow you does not work in long form.
I try. There was this. Do you know Megan McCarthy? She was a Viner.
That name is super familiar, so yeah. I probably do.
She's got a very high pitched voice. It sounds like a cartoon, and all her vines were so funny. And this
that
like
sounds familiar. Yeah.
Production company hired me to write like a cartoon for her, and the whole production kind of fizzled because it just didn't translate to long form like television.
Yeah.
And I felt really bad for her, but I'm like,
oh. But last time I saw Ethan and Sunny, I was I'm keep pitching them hard because they keep doing this antiquing thing on their Instagram.
Oh, I know.
Like, guys,
the best.
This as a mockumentary is so good.
They should go to IFC with that shit.
Oh my God, it would be so good. I'm like, please just write up a freaking paragraph, and I will take it to everybody.
I know, right?
Because they're so entertaining. Like, Ethan's way funnier than anyone knows.
Yeah.
And Sunny just does characters all day. Like, I know. All she does is, I don't know.
And they're funny together. They're really
so
couple.
Funny together.
So, yeah.
They're an awesome couple. And they have this, like, crazy dog with these googly eyes.
I know.
It just works. Just totally works. And they, like, essentially, it's not like they're like, short for money. They're doing great, but they, like, live in the car half the town. Just like, this is awesome,
I
guys.
Know.
You're just in a camper in Atlanta.
Insane.
Like, that's finding insane. Candle holders. It's so good.
So any production companies, please hit us up.
No, we'll take our idea.
But no. We want a cut, though.
Yeah. No, if you do exactly. it without us, we get 10%, right?
We want like some kind of creative credit.
Come on, damn it.
I know. There's so much crap on like Netflix that I feel like the good stuff is not being made. But
yeah. I don't know. You know, they have the catch-all right now. It's really interesting to like sit down and have meetings with them and kind of do the like, oh, what are you guys looking for? And it is sort of like, we're just building. Like, yeah. We're just over here stacking. We want good stuff, but it's sort of, I don't know how you guys feel when you go out and talk to people about projects, but I always feel like it's really up to like essentially one person's taste per location.
Oh, 100%.
And that person is like in and out of there in 3 years and somewhere else later.
Yeah.
So it's kind of like, you kind of just got to follow the person whose taste agrees with yours and be like, you're where now? Cool. I'll come pitch there.
And every time they ask you in a general meeting, they're like, so what do you want to do? Like, you know,
have this meeting go somewhere.
That's what lay on the beach.
I always say, I'm like, I would like a second meeting and then a third and then maybe a paycheck. That'd be great.
Yeah.
That's
yeah.
what I say to my dates.
Oh, good.
Yeah. Well, except
just,
the paycheck
you don't send
part.
An invoice to your date?
No. I usually pay, actually.
Of course you do. You're a gentleman.
Pay up front. Yeah. Of course. I always pay, actually. But that's
anyway. So
I'd like to get the check now so she can get up and leave whenever she wants.
That's a good hat. You steal
either of us can storm off at any moment. No one feels
that's
bad. Like it's already paid.
Exactly.
Yeah. Just leave your credit card with them and whatever happens, happens.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what's next for you? Or do you not even want to share?
I'm in that like shitty period where like there's stuff, but I can't like.
It's not shitty. It's good.
It's great, but I can't talk about it's anything. Fine. I'm just yeah. like, cool. This supposedly it's going to be in deadline soon. I can be like, that's it. That's the thing.
Oh, right. Okay. One of those.
But
things.
There's some acting stuff. There's some like writing and producing stuff. And like what was great about the movie for us is it was just a great showcase on all fronts of what we can do.
Yeah.
And then lucky for me, Diggs is on a TV show, so he can't do shit for the next 6 months. So they got to call me.
Wow. Oh, that's good.
Awesome. No, like we have a bunch of projects that we're doing together. We have some that are separate and things that we're sort of helping each other on. But it's great. Like we're in the right. It seems like.
I really, like I told you this. I think this is going to win something. Like, this is going to win some sort of big award.
As long as it wins me jobs.
It'll win you jobs.
And
but
here's the question.
I'm putting money on it.
At the end of the day, do you want to be, would you want writing jobs or do you want acting jobs? Or
I want
does
all
it
of them. I really do want all of them. I think the only thing that I'm not that into mm-hmm. at this point is just writing.
Okay.
Like, I think if I'm doing a thing, like, I want to be a producer on it or I want
to
be
You want
a
to have
like
your
I'll,
hands in
yeah,
it more.
I think at this point, like, the thing that I'm most excited about is people have some sense of my point of view on things, and mm-hmm. I'd like to like not let that fizzle away by being a little bit of a like a hired gun.
What if I want you to be in my new sitcom
as an actor?
Yeah.
Sure. Is it good?
No, I mean
he's not ready.
I'm just saying, like, is that
then? Yeah, like yeah. No, I mean I do like auditions and all that shit all the time.
Oh,
like,
okay.
They're pushing me hard on that, which is great. And I love acting. I think the beauty of being able to have a little bit of a reputation as a writer now is. Because I have work there, mm-hmm. I don't have to take the thing that I'm not totally in love with because
right.
I need rent paid.
Right, right.
For now, for the immediate future, rent is good.
Yeah.
And now I just want to find stuff that is exciting. And also, like, I have a lot of really talented friends or like people who are great actors and great writers. And I'm like, well, if I'm a producer, I can hire.
Yeah. Right. I know.
If I'm just an actor, I'm just a hired gun.
If my movie gets made, I want you in it.
That's it.
Go.
I would love that.
Is that the pinnacle, being able to say no to things and not having to worry?
I think the power in this town is the power of no.
Yeah.
It's like, I do not actually need that. So either make it better or make it more interesting
or
go find
more.
Somebody else or pay me more or go somewhere else, but appeal to some aspect of what my sort of Maslow's hierarchy of needs are. Like, give me something valuable.
Yeah.
But I think mostly right now, like, because I don't have some like, you know, insatiable desire to be some multimillionaire and I'm comfortable and fine, then all I really want to do is make cool shit with my art friends. Like,
yeah.
that's kind of the MO. And luckily there's enough of those and friends are always being like, here's this great script I have, and most of the time I read it, I'm like, there's a thing here.
Yeah.
Let's work on that. Let's make enough relationships with enough studios where the trust is there.
Yeah.
Where maybe I'm not involved, but that's awesome. I know this person from these couple of meetings we had that I think will love you and want to be into this.
I think it's fun about this industry is that because there's so many components to a movie, it's so many moving parts, and you can be so many parts of that parts.
Yeah.
And like, it's such, it feels to me like summer camp when you like film a movie, and it's like, it's this real community type. Okay, we're making something together and all that stuff. So the opportunity to do that like again and then hire the same people or find out, discover new people is just kind of really rewarding.
And if I love the artist, like if it's somebody who I believe in their vision, like that is the incentive enough for me to take a way smaller role or not even just as an actor, but like in the production of it.
Right.
Like, cool, I'm just consulting or I'm just going to be a script doctor to help you through the last draft or whatever it is. I think that in the few different industries that I've worked in, the more you get into those healthy spaces where there's really good people around you that just generally want the thing to succeed.
More Jess and then Keith.
that is a big thing of Jess and Keith's culture. I think that's why we line up so much. I don't even know if we got any of that from each other. I think we saw that in each other, that like we come from arts community work. Like they're not necessarily, I mean, I think they would love to be a big, big studio, but not at the expense of losing their personal touch or their personal relationships. They're so loyal to the people they work with. And I think now when I go and sit with different studios, I'm like looking for, how long have your people been here?
Yeah. Is there a turnover rate?
Like, are you just flipping houses or have you been here for like, you've been here for, it's one of the reasons that we liked working with Lionsgate so much is like, you know, some of the folks that have been there a long time, Joe Drake, who like has been the champion of our film and Jason Constantine, all these folks, like they believe in that, you know.
You need people in your corner.
Hit or miss on the movies, like they believe in their shit. They, you know, our meeting to get acquired by Lionsgate happened at like 1 a.m. in the basement of one of those like mansions at Sundance. But it was 2.5 hours long. Like people were crying about the subject material and like why we need these kind of films in the world and why this is like aligned with their mission statement. And even if we didn't go with them, please make sure that you ask for these things so that this gets its just due.
That's sick.
To the point where it was like, now it doesn't matter whether or not this is a massive success or an indie success, because we know you put your love in it. And that's kind of, and I feel like if I get a career where I get to have that kind of love in everything that I do, then like I'll be broke as fucking happy.
That's all you need. I mean, money won't make you happy, but being happy will make you happy.
Yeah.
Be satisfied with what you do.
Yeah.
You know? No one died being like, ah, wish I made more money.
No, I mean, I'm sure they did, but that is a miserable person's comment.
I know. I don't want to hang out with that guy.
No happy person died that way.
There you go.
I always tell people, like, no one died being like, I wish I got more likes on that photo or some shit.
Yeah. No. My friend got me to come over his house the other day because he's like, what are you doing? I'm like, oh, I'm working. He's like, nobody's on their deathbed saying that they just wish they did a little more work. I'm like, all right, fuck, I'm coming out.
Yeah, but it also depends what you're working on.
If you're working
on something that's like awesome.
What if it's like your passion project?
I mean, I'd like work, but yeah, I mean.
Yeah, if it's
I like other things too.
For all the grunt things I've done, if I'm at home working on a script and people are like, come out and drink, I'm like, well, that sounds expensive.
And it is.
And I'm like, that sounds like $100.
Yeah.
Because after the second drink, I'm buying all of you guys drinks.
Yeah.
Because I'm that person. And I love myself for being that person, only in that moment, though.
Right. Yes.
And I'm going to stay home and like work on this thing that I'm super in love with. And that like one day, if it gets made, I get to hire like 140 people. Yeah. Like
I do actually, like 3 days a week, I have like I call it a study hall, but for female writers at my house.
Oh, that's awesome.
And they all come in and I'm like, hey, it's like 3 or 4 girls and work on whatever you want for like 3 hours. And
it's just like quiet time and like a little bit of food and like,
doing exactly. Every hour we take a 5-minute break and if we have to talk, we'll talk and be like, fuck, I hate this. And then go back and then an hour.
And are they all like working writers? They're like people that
are
on.
Some of them are comics or stand-up comics. And they're working on material. It's really whatever. I sometimes don't even work on something. I read a lot.
Yeah.
I read a lot of scripts and a lot of books. And sometimes I can't do that during the day. I just need to focus. Especially when something I need to like soak in.
Yeah.
So I do it then. But I think the discipline, I've seen these women produce so much better and like efficient things just doing that 3 days a week. And they're like, I don't want to go out anymore. You're doing your study hall again. And it's an amazing thing that I love to do.
I'm sure it makes them feel like they're a part of something.
Yeah. That's another thing.
You know, anytime I like invite someone, like I'm going to go work at a cafe for 4 hours. Do you or you and whoever want to come? And you sit there and you're like, you don't talk.
I'm here.
But you see how hard the other person's working. It's like, this is what it takes. It's a freaking job. Like, let's
feed off it.
Yeah. And especially if it's somebody you admire, you respect the way they work.
Right.
You know, being able to lean over and being like, ah, I'm just trying to figure out this one part. It's just like vocalizing it does such a thing.
Right. That's why we have a board, too.
Yeah. I haven't gotten the hang of the board yet. I'm a post-it person.
You're a post-it person?
Yeah.
I'm a note card person, but the board is just for when there's other people in the room.
Yeah.
And they need, like, it's for like a writer's room type of feel. Anyway, but you're welcome to come here.
This is a beautiful place.
I use it.
Is this your house?
It's not a women's only writer's room? Male can
It help. Started because I'm on this forum for women writers, and I wanted it to feel safe. Like, I wanted people I know to come. Like, I just do like an open call type thing. I didn't know these women. But, and then I got to know them, and I was like, it started just one day a week, and then people loved it so much. I was like, fuck it, I'm going to do 3 days a week.
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
That's
and
awesome.
And then the work gets done. And it's better than a cafe.
Yeah.
I don't know. We have better food. We have Postmates here.
Yeah, that's there you go.
It can literally be anything.
It could be anything.
On a side note, I'm over Postmates. I'm very angry at them. I'll just cut this out, whatever. But long and short, I signed up for Postmates.
They might be sponsoring this.
I signed them up. I sign up for them. It says $100 in free delivery, right? And so
do it's
it.
Like incremental.
No, it's you have it for a week. Who the fuck uses $100 in delivery?
My writing,
in 1 week?
My writing partner daily does.
Me.
Are you serious? Are you kidding me?
Yeah,
I could do that in a day.
Yeah, I was gonna say like I could do that.
I could
in
breakfast
a day.
Legend due to that. You just gotta order the filet.
I used it once.
Or the lobster.
Or the lobster.
It was like $7 for delivery. I'm like, what?
Order the kale juice.
I could do that in two orders. Are you kidding me? Invite a friend over and let me get in dessert. Do you want cheesecake? Okay.
Yeah,
maybe it's just me.
My writing partner in a movie that I'm working on, she postmated one day. She postmated just a bottle of water.
Yeah.
So well, that's insane.
I've done it with Froyo. What? I postmated Froyo. I didn't post it. I guess it was
she
it was
does it too,
it was Grubhub or whatever. And I was like, I just want some ice cream. I don't want to go anywhere. bring it to me.
Froyo
add sprinkles.
Like, yourself. It's this whole thing. No.
Yeah, but it is. But it's also really satisfying to have someone like hand it to you through your door. Like, wow, you brought this to me. It's in a to-go container.
I was working really late one night with my friend editing, and we at like 2 a.m. were like, "Dude, do you want Chex Mix?"
Really?
Wow. There was one when I used to teach at UW-Madison, and they had this thing. Oh my god, what was it called? It was like you can get delivery until like 4 a.m.
Pink Dot.
No, it was like a college kid run thing, and I couldn't really go. I was 23 at the time teaching undergrad, so like I couldn't go out and party at bars because my students were there, and so I would sit at home and do this delivery stuff. But they would deliver like anything from like bagel bites to like hookahs to like cigars to condoms.
Yeah.
So I always thought it was really funny to like order as many weird things as possible
right.
and group them all together, and then like write, "Please hurry." I'd be like, I need a hookah. I need Kohl's. I need bagel bites, I need 7 condoms, and I need a black and mild and cream cheese. Get here now.
All the stuff that I'm nervous to buy that I used to be nervous, like pregnancy tests and all those things, I always Amazon them.
Yeah.
And
really?
Smart. Like I bulk them too. So like I have
just like slide in the pregnancy like test like a month.
Because I have five pregnancy tests. I don't know if they go, do they expire? I hope not.
Oh, I don't know.
So I bought them like a year ago, and I'm like, I don't know when I'm going to need them, but like, fuck it. And if my friend wants one, I have one.
Right.
And like, I just bought bulk condoms. Like, fuck it. Anything embarrassing, I'm buying on Amazon.
I like never thought of that. That's
that's
great
really
way to do
great
it.
Tip.
It never gets less uncomfortable to buy condoms.
No. I know.
And you should be proud. You're like,
you should be like, I'm being responsible. I'm trying to be safe, trying to respect her and myself.
Magnums, okay?
Like the biggest fuck. Come on, let me get that one.
Not embarrassing.
But I will say, like, the thing about that is when you ask, especially if you're asking for magnums, the clerk always does something. It's the smallest reaction, but they just kind of go, "These ones?" It's some little, huh. Or just like, okay. Like, all right. Like, don't judge me.
Or just like a sniff. You're like, all right.
Okay.
I know.
Showing off, are you?
Also a hack I do, because I have stairs, and I don't want to pick shit up.
Yeah.
I don't have muscles. If something's really heavy, like laundry detergent, I'll just Amazon Prime that, because they bring it literally to my doorstep.
It's also smart.
Yeah.
I lived in New York for 2 years, and all I did was get delivery groceries. Yeah. It was the greatest thing ever. Yeah. That and like I've got all my services down. Like, come get my laundry, fold that shit, bring it back. What, $30? Absolutely. They have that shit in LA now. I'm like really hard to resist.
Huh?
Them coming and like picking up your bag and bringing the shit back.
Do it.
Yeah, yeah, it's expensive.
Oh, yeah, no. That's the problem.
If it wasn't so much money and I didn't have a washer dryer, like it's purely I don't want to fold them. That's
your next film's going to be great. And
yeah,
you can do it.
This is it. Yeah, my next film, if I nail that shit, I can have somebody else fold my laundry.
Once I see like a, you're gonna get on that.
Man, we'll see how a deadline goes.
So our famous second to last question is, what do you feel like your biggest failure is?
My biggest failure... Like as an overall note of who I am, or like a moment.
What one sticks with you? What just popped into your head, whether it's professional or otherwise?
Or emotional, or something else.
Something makes you cry, that'd be wonderful.
Oh, yeah. If I could just get deep on you guys for a second. What are things that... There's been a few moments recently, and I think this is more just like the riddle of what I'm trying to solve next to my charisma. Very like outspoken, you know. I talk a lot of shit on Twitter. I try to do it as like succinct. It's not shit. Like I try to be really succinct and like
you have a point
and
of
like
view.
I write it in advance. I like scan it for stupidity to make sure that I don't. Yeah, I'm like I don't want to just like fire off
smart.
And I've done it a few times, and it's become a thing that then like consumes my life for 3 or 4 months because it gets in the press or whatever. And there's moments when that's happened where the conversation gets, there's so many people that get dragged into it, and there's so many people that bandwagon and polarize the sides that it just, everyone's miserable. Like every side of it is miserable. Even when I reach out and try to talk to whoever I was sort of opposed to, they reach out to me. We're under so much public scrutiny that everyone's afraid the other person's going to like screen grab or record something
right.
to just make it more of a shit show or more of a reality TV thing. And I just, the few moments that it's happened, I think my regret is never that I did it. It's that I didn't crack the code on what like phase two is
mm-hmm.
of like, how do we have a town hall or how do we like, how is this at all?
Right.
Helpful. Actually progressive.
Right.
Whereas like right now I think we're still in that phase in social media where we're like shouting into
the
void.
Yeah.
Yeah, and we're yelling to our choir and not necessarily to anyone else. And I think even the few moments that I've had like gripes with people, they're people that in theory are on my side. They just like miss something big that's like really offensive. And it's like you're actually not the other side of the aisle. You're like you're on my side over here. We're just like a few rows apart.
Right.
And I both want to raise the awareness about the thing and know that there is a certain tone that gets it up. I want to manage like how angry to make it so that it gets up, but not so much that it shuts everyone on the other side down and we go into defense. I had this big thing happen with this Broadway show, The Great Comet, that eventually closed because of things that me and some other people in the New York scene said about a terrible mistake they made with casting. But I felt that the mistake was so fixable and actually like a really beautiful teachable moment that could really benefit everyone.
I wonder what happened to that show.
It closed
it opened and then it was gone.
It opened, it like got nominated for a bunch of awards. I saw it. It was a very beautiful show. But without getting back into the drama of it, like there was just a careless decision made at the expense of one actor that many of us felt would ripple to a lot of other actors of color and needed to get corrected. Mm. And the conversation just got, because it got so defensive and so polarized, no one was willing to sort of have the version of the conversation that was necessary.
Right.
And played cards so close to the chest until it was too late and the show was closing. And so they lost. And their show closed and they took a bath and the cast lost their jobs and the producers took bath on that. And all the people who criticized it got vilified. You know, we got harassed for forever and like, and are still getting harassed about it. And like that to me is a win for no one.
Yeah. Right? No
like,
one won.
Our side totally agrees and is like, and the New York Times backed us and Forbes backed us. And like, all, you know, all these people wrote about it.
Yeah.
But that doesn't really come to any resolve. And I think like...
It leaves a bad taste in people's mouths.
In everyone's mouths, you know?
Yeah.
And so I think that is one of the like the learning failures of us trying to climb the mountain of what it means to like have a voice in the public space.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That I think not only for me, but most people online are trying to figure out, we're like, all right, when we clap back on somebody online, do you have another idea for like then how to, and I presented a bunch of ideas to them, but by the time they read them, they were like, we're not talking to you. This is going to be a disaster. And like, you know, I sympathize with that. Like they would have to trust me in order to do that.
Yeah.
Yeah. I felt that way with women too, when there's like an issue going around with women writers, like, oh, I was sexually harassed, do I come out with it? And then it gets like circulated and then it's like
it's suddenly
women
like,
take sides. People get mad at Lena Dunham for supporting someone who like it's like ah.
Yeah.
We're all on the same team.
We're all looking at it and we all have varying degrees of opinions every time something comes out.
Yeah.
I kinda came at Sean Penn after his comments about the Me Too movement. And tried to phrase them every time, do it a little bit more delicately because of the experience of seeing what happens. And of course, when you're tweeting, you're also not saying like, I also really admire this person as an artist and I've really enjoyed their career.
That's
like, it's not like I don't have one opinion of this, but I have an opinion of this thing that they said.
Right.
There was a YouTuber a long time ago, his name is escaping me now, who when he was talking about how to talk to somebody about like when something racist happens, how to talk about it. It's like, never be like, you're racist, but to be like, that thing that you said,
right,
the thing that you said that is racist, and give them a chance to go, either I didn't mean that, or I phrased that wrong, or that is my belief. And if that is your belief, like, let's dig into what that is and what that fear is.
Yeah.
So I think sometimes with some of the things online now, I'm a little bit more careful to be like, that's fucked up, to like, did you mean that?
Yeah.
Like, ask the question a little more communally. Like,
yeah.
Did you mean
Don't
for
be
it to
so
come out the
to
way?
Judge, essentially.
That's how it's coming. Because I think what happens is we like accuse, everyone gets mad, and then the person comes out and goes, that's a little out of context. And we're like, bullshit. Right. It's out of context because you're in trouble now. And it's like, well, they're only in trouble because we gave them no chance to clarify.
Right. Yeah.
And having done a lot of press now, like, sometimes the press is like, interview 100. Of day 5 of a press tour.
Yep.
And someone's like, how do you feel about this? And you're like, I don't have fucking time for that right now.
Right.
And then people are like, doesn't care about the issue. And it's like, no, yeah. That fool is exhausted.
He's tired. Yeah.
You know.
Well, I think I just as an observer, I think you're fine on Twitter.
Thank you.
Fuck anyone.
I think
who
so
thinks
too.
Fuck
no, I stand by my positions.
And Guy, do you want to do our last?
Sure. Our last question, as always, is, do you have a favorite charity?
Favorite charity? Oh, that's right. I was supposed to think about this. I totally didn't.
Yeah.
How does a charity work? Does a charity qualify as a nonprofit qualify as a charity, or it has
whatever
to be like a charity?
Wherever you want the money to go, that's where it's going to go.
Can we go to the ACLU?
Yeah,
sure. We've done that before. Yeah. So $100 to the ACLU, American Civil Liberties Union. If you don't know what they do, look it up. But we're going to give them on your behalf.
You're welcome.
Thank you from failing up. And thank you so much for being on the podcast.
Thanks for
having
me.
Appreciate it.
Everybody see Blind Spotting. Is it out on anything? On demand?
It's in theaters. It comes out on, I don't think I can say the date yet, but very soon comes to like iTunes.
And fun.
Awesome.
Yeah. Okay.
So check it out. And thank you again. Thanks for listening to Failing Up.
Bye.